Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Welcome, Mancast. Justin's here.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest this week is he's the owner and proprietor of Media OCD, who masters Blu-rays for, you know, I don't know, half the anime industry. It's Justin Savakis. Justin, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, everyone.
This is
weird.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about it for a little while, like. You know, since we started the show, you and I started, we're getting close to our 200th episode, and we started this in 2008.
Holy crap.
Yeah, so,
really?
Yeah.
No, it had to be 09, because I didn't move here till 09. Still, it's been 5 years.
It's been, okay, 09, you're right, it's been 5 years. For some reason, like, because I know our first episode was about Ponyo, and, like, that had just come out, or was just coming out.
So we were just bitching about how not great it was.
Yeah, and so for some reason I was associating that with 2008 in my head, but I guess that was 2009. Mm. So 2009 was when we started this. And you were full-time at ANN then.
Yes, I was. And I just moved to LA.
Right, and your life has completely changed since then.
Yeah.
And you have shifted away from the ANN side of things, and now you are effectively, you know, a member of the industry. And we don't talk, like, we have to tiptoe around this or be very careful about it on the podcast. Like, you don't comment about shows that you worked on, which is getting more difficult because you work on more and more stuff.
Yeah, tell me about it. Every time NIS comes up, every time Discotech comes up, and now every time Viz comes up, I just can't say anything. And that's really, I mean, that people will notice I'm on the show less and less, and that's a large part why, because I just can't talk.
Yeah, you know, or if you can, it's just from the perspective that we're going to be talking about today. But we're basically sort of taking the shackles off, and we're just going to talk about what you do for a living now.
Right.
So I guess describe what you do, because I think this is going to, that's the major sort of stumbling block, is like, it's hard to sum it up really easily, I guess.
No, I'm going to give you a list.
Okay.
All right. So I do the authoring for Blu-ray for NIS, and even though I don't have any, you know, exclusivity agreement with them, I've done all of their Blu-rays to date, and I don't think they talk to anyone else about it.
Okay.
They might have some sort of backup plan in case I get hit by a bus or something.
Right.
All the Blu-rays for Discotech and some of the compression for the DVDs, but not the actual authoring at their DVDs. They do that themselves. Through an agreement with Bang Zoom, I do some authoring for Viz, both DVD and Blu-ray. Also for the Korean company CJ Entertainment, for their DVDs and Blu-rays for their live-action movies. Let's see, for TMS, I do encoding and uploading to Hulu, you know, going through their huge catalog of shows, processing them, making them Hulu ready, which is a little more difficult than one would think, and uploading those. And I've done occasional jobs for a few other companies, and there are a couple other clients I am chasing. And I also do some output for theatrical distribution for indie film.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. What does authoring mean?
Okay, authoring is DVDs and Blu-ray are basically software, and DVDs are simple enough that they can pretty much be arranged, and all of the button mapping and all of the way that the disc works and can pretty much be done with a graphical interface. But Blu-ray is much harder and has to be actually hand-coded. Like, I actually am doing programming. It's simple programming. It's not like I'm coding entire apps in C or anything, but there is a language you have to learn, and you have to compress all of the video and audio into their proprietary formats, and just make sure everything works. Which, is pretty hard sometimes. You want me to go through everything step by step? Because that'd probably be the easiest way to go about it.
Yeah, I think just to give people an idea of exactly what you do, because like I hear authoring and I'm like, okay, so
what does this
mean? Like burning a DVD-R like we used to do back in the day, you know, where you just like dump the video TS files onto something and...
Well, the actual authoring is I make the video TS files.
Okay, right.
Right.
So like, I guess just walk us through it. Like what's the process?
Well, when a company, say a Funimation or an NIS or whoever, licenses something from Japan, they basically get either a master tape on HD cam, which is literally a big cassette tape. It looks like an overgrown VHS tape, if you've never seen one. And it has a more or less nearly uncompressed full video and 8 tracks of uncompressed audio. It's a lot of data. And either they get that, or they just get a file that has the exact same thing on it. And that file is usually this gigantic QuickTime ProRes file, usually around, we're talking 35 to 40 gigs an episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are huge, and they're broadcast quality. They are perfect. They're, you know, unblemished. And they're also easy to edit. You know, the way that the file is structured is not complicated, so editing software doesn't have to keep track of too many things when you're shuttling around and, you know, slicing things up and things like that. Now, depending on the licensor and, you know, what state the master tape was in when this was done, that master file might be formatted for television, so it might still have long, like, minute and a half of black at every commercial break. It might still have the, you know, you never know what's going to be on there. Bonus material could be at the end of an episode after a long segment of black and some bars and tone or something. There's all sorts of junk on there you need to trim out. So the first step is you throw it in like Final Cut Pro or Adobe Premiere or something like that, and you just trim it so it looks how it should presentation-wise. Real simple editing doesn't really take that long. And you also make sure you're getting the right audio tracks. Like, usually those masters have stereo left and right for the Japanese, and then stereo left and right for the M&Es, or, you know, the isolated audio track they use to make the dub that doesn't have any Japanese dialogue on it. So once you sort all that out, you export it the way it should be on the disc, then you give it to me. And so I take that video file, I plug it into several encoding pieces of software. I have a small arsenal of software I've amassed over the years to do this. I shrink down that 40 gigabyte file to maybe 4 or 5 gigabytes for Blu-ray. And if I did it right, nobody can tell the difference. And that's the compression, and that's really hard. You know, it took me a long time to get my secret sauce right for that.
So that's really like, you know, because eventually we'll get into like how do problems happen on Blu-rays, like video quality problems and stuff like that. Like, where does that come from? But it sounds like you have to have like your own personal like formula.
Well, yeah, and every video is different. Well, most are the same, but you occasionally get thrown a curveball. For example, you might get something where the master tape itself had a lot of banding and it looks really funky. Or you might get something where one episode randomly is interlaced because they cut it together really quick because it's a recap episode.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically have to know what to do with that and how to encode it, or if it needs it, filter it to make it look better. There are all sorts of little tricks of the trade. And then for DVD, you have to then shrink it down to standard definition and encode that to be DVD compliant. And that'll be basically 1 gig per episode. And audio has to be done separately, but audio is easy. That's like, it's not demonstrably harder than making an MP3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Except for 5.1. 5.1 is a little bit of a pain in the butt because you have to export it as 6 individual WAV files, you know, one for each channel. And they have to be, you know, make sure you don't mix them up because my desk is only stereo and I won't be able to tell until I burn a disc. So, you know, you have to label each one, be really meticulous about which is which, and, you know, throw that in the encoder, map them right away. But, yeah, it's really not that hard. That's like making a more complicated MP3.
Okay, so you've done the compression at this point. What software do you use to do that?
I use a combination of things. For the audio, I just use this used to be expensive, but now quite cheap software by Apple called Compressor. That used to be part of the whole Final Cut Pro suite of applications, but now you can just buy it on the Mac App Store for $50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's really easy. And that allows me to extract the audio. If it's stereo, I just use WAV files. That's, you know, PCM on compressed audio for Blu-ray, and then Dolby Digital for DVD. And that has a nice encoder built in. For DTS Master Audio for 5.1, I had to buy a special encoder for that, and that's actually a plug-in for a very old version of Compressor that no longer works with the current operating system, and I have to keep my old Mac Pro around for that.
Yeah,
that's literally sitting in my kitchen still because I can't get rid of it.
So is that like a thing where, you know, if you're upgrading your equipment, the tools that in your specific line of work... Because, you know, okay, so I'm going to draw an analogy here. Like, you know how when, like, iPhones and, like, the iPad were going to Retina displays?
Mm-hmm.
And you, like, so I bought an iPad 3 right when it came out, and nothing was ready for the Retina display yet.
Yeah, everything just looked jaggy and crappy.
Yeah, right. So you're kind of stuck using old, you got to use the old stuff until they catch up with your suite of software.
Like, yeah, professional software just it's not as well maintained or as polished as consumer software or even the nice professional software. Like, you know, we're all used to the Adobe Creative Suite.
Right.
Professional software.
Right.
But so polished and so refined that it's like it's just super powered consumer software.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff that I get to use is kind of janky and can sit there more or less unupdated for the better part of a decade.
Well, okay, so when there's a change or when a piece of software that you were relying on goes away, does that fuck with your secret sauce? Is that like a big, it's like, oh God, this is going to take me, like I got to find the new solution to this?
So
changes everything?
You get to be really good at maintaining backwards compatibility. Like for example, you know, I'm constantly bouncing back between Windows and Mac. And my main Windows machine that I do all the actual authoring on is running Windows 7 64-bit.
Right.
But on my Mac Pro, I have Windows also running in VMware. Let me know if I'm getting too technical here.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
the people who will understand what you're talking about will understand what you're talking about. So.
Okay, VMware, if you're not familiar, is one of several pieces of software that lets you run Windows in a window on your Mac. And that's running Windows XP, and I have to keep that around because there is a lot of stuff that I use that is not compatible with Windows 7.
Wow.
Yep.
So this is a bunch of moving parts, and you basically have to keep a bunch of obsolete shit around in order to make it all work in concert.
It's very Rube Goldberg.
It sounds like.
And yeah, a lot of the stuff I use, frankly, were invented as kind of like nerdy hacker tools when DVD was first becoming a thing and people were figuring out how to, you know, reverse engineer them and make their own.
Yeah.
And there's just not been anything better. And the professional stuff just isn't, just never had to go there. But you end up finding that you need it on a regular basis. And so I'm still using, you know, hacked together stuff from Doom 9 forums from 2003.
Wow. Dang. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Like, I dabbled in making my own DVDs back in the day. Like, a lot of people did, you know.
Sure.
But that was really easy, really fast. I wouldn't even think about doing it with Blu-ray. Like, it just seems so... Like you were saying, you got to hand-code this stuff.
Yeah, Blu-ray is a whole other nightmare for a number of reasons we'll get into in a second.
Right. So, okay, so...
Okay, so that's the... We finished the video and we finished the audio.
Okay.
Now it comes time for the subtitles.
All right. All right.
And subtitles are the worst. I hate subtitles. Because with both DVD and Blu-ray, you can't just, you know, throw a text file in the authoring software and hit go. You have to actually use several of those hacker tools I mentioned to render out all of those subtitles as graphics.
Right. And this is specific to Blu-ray.
This is both. This is every disc format.
Oh, okay.
Blu-ray was actually supposed to be able to render text, but they forgot to include a text renderer or any fonts in the actual Blu-ray firmware.
Lovely.
So if you wanted, it's just, yeah, it's a non-starter. Just don't even think about it. So yeah, Blu-ray, all the subtitle, every subtitle, each individual screen of subtitles gets rendered out as a PNG, a transparent PNG file. Mm-hmm. And as far as DVD goes, DVD is so freaking old. Those are four color graphics, and one of those colors has to be clear. So, you know, because the whole thing is a graphic file that gets layered on top of the video. So one of the four colors has to be cleared so you can know what you see under the subtitles.
Dang.
That's why DVD subtitles look so jaggy, because you can't anti-alias, because you only have three colors to work with.
Right. Okay.
So you map all those out, and there are all sorts of little stupid rules, like you can't have, on DVD, you can't have a subtitle less than three frames, or certain players will just shut off the subtitles. That bug has been around forever, and I just noticed it's in my brand new Sony Blu-ray player.
Oh, really?
I can't believe that bug still exists.
They've been there since the 90s?
Yep. Blu-ray, it's even worse. I think it's five frames that your subtitles have to be on. Otherwise, the mux won't work, and when you send the disc in to the replicator, they'll just reject it. But that's the best case scenario. Worst case scenario, it goes out and half the players choke on the disc and you have to recall them. So yeah, all sorts of little nightmares like that. I'm just scratching the surface. And this is a particular nightmare with anime, because you have so much on-screen text that happens while people are talking. You have so much people talking over each other, and that causes all sorts of havoc.
Right, so you're sort of stuck in, you're sort of working with the most difficult material when it comes to subtitling, because subtitling is incredibly important on anime discs. Like, you can't kind of, like, fudge it. Like, I would imagine some other authoring houses fudge this kind of stuff, because it sounds really difficult to get it exactly right.
Well, you can't get it exactly right, honestly. A lot of the times, you can't be frame accurate with both a sign and a person speaking if they're at the same time. Because, you know, one... The way that works is, you know, you have to end up splitting that into three graphics. You know, the first graphic is, you know, is just one subtitle. Second graphic is both subtitles, where they overlap. And then the third graphic is where it's just the second subtitle. First of all, if you try to do that on Blu-ray, every time the graphics refresh, they blink. There's ways around it, but it's usually not worth the trouble.
Yeah.
Second of all, if any of those little tags at the beginning or end are shorter than five frames, your mux fails. So, you know, you basically have to fudge it as best you can.
What is mux? Just so people know.
I'm sorry. Mux is when you're doing the compile, when you're compiling all this stuff together. Muxing is where it's actually interweaving all of the video and audio and subtitles. So it can just pull data off the disc in one straight line and, you know, kind of unweave it to get both the audio and video and subtitles in synchronous.
So it's kind of like, syncopation. It's kind of like that's when you put all the ingredients for your bread in the pan and you pull it out of the oven.
Exactly. Well, that's the mixing. It's okay. Muxing is like mixing. It's mixing all the ingredients together so the player can just play them.
Right. So the bread can be made.
Exactly.
All right.
So yeah, once all the subtitles are done, you have this giant folder full of graphics files and a text file that includes all the time codes. You know, what graphics file goes where. And you have that for every individual track on the disc. So say you have nine episodes, three trailers, and a couple extra features. Each one of those has all of its own audio tracks, all of its own subtitle tracks, and all of its own encoded video files.
Okay.
So all that together, and, you know, that even includes, you know, the FBI warning, the sorry, this is the wrong region screen. That's all a video file you have to make. So all that together, that all goes into a big folder if you're organized, and that's called assets. And those are all your assets, and those are all the stuff that makes a disc. So now we're ready to talk about menus.
Okay. See, and now this I'm curious about. Yeah. So I wanted to ask this about menus, like up front. So, like, a lot of the software comes with, like, default menus, right? Like, there's like the software has it built in.
DVD does, Blu-ray does not.
Oh, so there is no, like, default, like, here's just, like, you can just use this one, that like, this template that we just sort of threw into the software.
No, it's too complicated. I suppose you could make your own, but, you know, you would end up spending so much time in Photoshop, it's barely worth the trouble.
Oh, the reason I ask is because there are a number of Warner Brothers Blu-rays that have this incredibly generic, like, really bad-looking menu. That
yeah, Warner Universal makes does that, too.
Oh, I hate that. That Universal shit's from HD DVD. I hate that menu. And you gotta, you gotta hit the disc pop-up button to get it away from that stupid screensaver mode that it goes into. Oh, I hate that shit.
I'll tell you why they did that. The reason being is, you know, when Blu-ray was first being developed, everyone was all excited that it ran Java.
Oh, God.
As with everything that runs Java, Java fucking sucks.
Right.
And, you know, because Blu-ray is such a compatibility nightmare, it took them forever to get a recipe that works. And now that they have it, they're like, never do anything else.
Okay.
Like, Blu-ray is so delicate with menu graphics, it does not, the format doesn't have enough RAM.
Right.
It just doesn't, to store all those graphics. So you have to be really, really sparing as far as how big your buttons are, how many layers your menu has, because you only have like 32 megabytes for all of the graphics that fill the screen.
Oh, geez.
You know, you have to be able to calculate time to pull that off the disc. It's this is all with Java. The way I make Blu-rays is way easier. And there's so much opportunity for things to go wrong. You know, players with weird implementations of Java, players with, you know, RAM that doesn't quite meet the spec, you know, things like that. That it's once they have a formula that works, I would never want to touch it again.
So the fact that I'm seeing the same, like, shitty-looking menu that looks like it came with whatever software they're using to put it together, somebody made that, and they're just like, fuck it, just use that.
I guarantee you Warner Brothers has way better authoring people and way better software than I do.
Man, doesn't explain these garbage menus.
You know, they've just decided that's, you know, nobody buys a Blu-ray for the menu.
That's true, but, like, you know, okay, so so part of the reason I bring this up is because it's the, like, you'll see the same menu with these same shitty looking buttons that look, it looks like no effort. It looks like zero effort was put into this. And it's, they put it on some of their biggest titles. So, like, the most recent one I saw that had this shitty menu on it was the Lego Movie, which was, like, their biggest release of the year. And it's got this garbage menu that they also used on, like, the recent anniversary edition of Little Shop of Horrors and, like, a couple other discs that I had bought. I'm like, man, this menu looks terrible. Why do they keep using it? It must have just come with the software. But so that's not true. Somebody made that. They're just using it over and over again.
They had to make that. And also Hollywood lobbied really hard for an extra layer of copy protection on their discs called BD Plus.
Okay, right.
Only the big Hollywood studios use that. And to use that copy protection, you have to make your disc in Java.
Oh, okay.
So they're stuck.
Copy protection sure is working.
Right? Yeah, Paramount gave up, finally, last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And that's why, you know, the newer Paramount discs, they're a lot less fancy, a lot less animation, a lot less bells and whistles, but they work and they're a lot less annoying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, actually, now that I think about it. Because I still buy plenty of Blu-rays. I still, you know, buy movies that I really liked in the theater and stuff like that, and catalog titles.
Yeah.
I've noticed that.
There are two different kinds of menu systems for Blu-ray. That's Java, and that's a nightmare, and I never wish to touch Java Blu-ray ever again. The kind I make is called HDMV. HDMV menus they work a little more like DVD menus, and they're a lot more reliable. The way you code them, once you have a code base that works, you can pretty much count on every player being able to read them without too much complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you have hard limitations. It's just, you have to code them directly by hand. Java, you know, there are tools available that you can, you know, do graphical development. But no, these you have to code by hand. It's harder, but it's worth it. The discs themselves are actually, or the menus themselves are actually two things. There is actually background video that you have to encode separately. And then the graphics elements themselves are made entirely in Photoshop in layers. So you have different pages of menu, and each page has a background layer and a bunch of buttons.
Okay, so you're effectively flipping through layers.
Exactly. Every time you say, you know, go to the extras menu, that's another page. So each page has its menu or has a background layer that, you know, all this is playing on top of the video, of course, and like six or seven or however many buttons. When you're making these in Photoshop, each button has three layers for each button state: normal, selected, activated. So for a disc where, like, say you have nine episodes and every episode has its own chapter submenu, mm-hmm. we're talking a Photoshop file with 200 plus layers.
Right.
And none of those buttons can overlap in any way, or, you know, that causes errors. So, yeah, making these menus is one of the... It's not easy, and it's very hard on graphic designers. I've had a few friends of mine work on menus for me. Luckily, NIS does their own.
Right, so you're not stuck.
Yeah. Right, and they've gotten very good at them over the years. But whenever I have to directly supervise a graphic artist doing it, they're just head in hands over how complicated it is. Oh, and every button has to be, or every layer has to be named a very specific way, because it all has to be imported by this authoring software.
Well, that sounds like a giant headache.
Yep. Yeah. Menus are not easy, but then you have to go through each button, and, you know, you have to select each button. It's like, what does it do when you hit up? What does it do when you hit left? What does it do when you hit right? What does it do when you hit down? What does it do when you hit enter? And each possible command gets lines of code.
So you just have to enter null for, like, however many buttons are on the remote?
Well, I mean, you're mapping it to do different things. So it's a little easier to map the directional buttons. Enter, you know, you get some code. And the code can be anywhere from one line, jump to this button, to, like, several paragraphs of code.
Okay. all right. So, excuse me.
Turnabouts for a play.
Yeah. Editing. So you've compressed the video. You've done the subtitles. You've finished with the menus. Then what?
Then once I'm done programming the menus, I map everything out in the authoring software. I point the authoring software to, you know, all of the assets. I define each track. I select what menu goes on to what track. For example, you know, the main menu gets the special main menu menu. And then the pop-up goes on all the program tracks. And then the little tiny, you know, go back to main menu goes on the all the extras. And then I add the chapter points, which are just a list of time codes.
Right.
And that can take a while because sometimes those get messed up. And then once everything is arranged, and each track gets its own code as well. Then I hit compile, and I pray, and I wait a half hour, and I come back, and I test and see what I screwed up. And it usually takes me about three or four builds before I get it clean enough to burn onto a disk and send to the client for them to do testing.
Okay, and so Blu-ray, like, you know, burnable singles are still not that cheap, right?
They've come down a lot. Single layer is actually under $1 a disk now.
Oh, okay.
Dual layer is still hovering around $3 to $5, depending on how you buy it. So yeah, that adds up pretty quick. In fact, I just had to spend like $200 on another spindle of 50.
Okay, so how many of these things do you go through in, like, say, like a month?
Oh, it varies wildly. Sometimes I'll go through like four or five. Sometimes I'll go through a lot more than that. Like, you know, I just did Cardcaptor Sakura that That was, I think we did two rounds of BDR on pretty much every disc, and that's 9 discs.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I burned through these, no pun intended.
Right. Holy shit. Yeah, that could get expensive.
Yeah, and, you know, that all has to get FedEx back to the client, and, you know, they have to do testing. Sometimes they hire an outside testing firm to make sure they get everything, because, you know, it's so easy to miss a typo on a subtitle, and so easy to, like, forget to hit a button.
Right.
See what happens, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're basically saying, like, there's a billion moving parts, and you have to make sure all of them work.
Not to mention, you know, there's compatibility testing. Certain things don't work on certain players, and you might not know that.
Right.
You know, and Blu-ray is so quirky and has so many weird gaps, I'm still finding out things it can't do.
Yeah, it's like you're just figuring out the limitations of the format rather than what it, you know, the magical world of what it can do. Like,
did you know that Blu-ray can show standard def interlaced, but it can't show standard def compressed?
Really?
Or progressive?
Really?
Yeah. found that one out the hard way.
Damn.
It's part of the spec. Can't do it.
Jeez. That's bizarre. All right, so you send the disc off, you burn the disc, you send it to them for testing and compatibility and everything, and they do all that testing themselves?
Yeah, most of them do at least most of the testing internally, and then they'll send it off to test a few things like compatibility or with, you know, lots of different models of players or, you know, region codes that they don't have the equipment to do in-house. Yeah, and then they'll come back and say, okay, here's some stuff you screwed up, here's some stuff we screwed up, and, you know, we'll just work together to find, to get the disc completely bug-free before we ship it off. And then once everyone is happy and everything is signed off and the disc is perfected as much as it can be, I make a special kind of file. For Blu-ray, it's called a BDCMF file, and for DVD, it's called a DDP file, which is a... Now, DVD, we used to have to send it off to replication. We used to have to use these clunky old data tapes, these DLT tapes, mm-hmm. And they stopped making those a decade ago, and those were getting really hard to track down. So now they all take files, and we send that off to the replication plant, and the replication plant does whatever magic they do. They etch a glass master in a clean room, they stamp a couple out, they send it to the client. And hopefully the client won't discover anything new that they screwed that got screwed up.
Right.
Either they or I screwed up, because that gets really expensive if they already made a glass master. And then if it's all systems go, then they start making the discs.
And so that's when your job is done.
Yes, I refer to sending in the those replication files as sliding the disc into the oven.
Okay. So where do the problems come in? Like what? Okay, so I kind of want to get into, like, moving away from, like, your work specifically,
mm-hmm.
Just for a little bit here. What do you look for in a Blu-ray? Like, say, like, you buy a Blu-ray from somebody else. You didn't work on it. What do you look for? Like, what stands out to you the most? Because, obviously, your eyes are ruined, like, for this sort of thing. So you're going to see every tiny little problem that pops up.
Oh, yeah. Just to give you an example, I just got the Blu-ray of Short Piece.
Yeah.
So I popped it in, and Sentai has this gorgeous new animated logo. It looks really nice.
It does look nice. I've seen that's the Galaxy one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks nice.
The compression, not so much. Ironically, that's the only part of that disc that looks bad.
It's
but
just their
that logo. That logo looks like a YouTube clip.
Poor Sentai.
They can't catch a break.
Yeah. No, you will notice, like, compression issues right away, and where does that come in? Like,
That happens. I mean, unless your master file has that has those compression artifacts, which is really unlikely, unless you're, you know, working on a documentary that used YouTube rips for source material, it's probably your compression.
So the when people get, like, an anime Blu-ray that's got compression problems, and the audio, the video doesn't look very good, and there's, like, noticeable, like, you know, video issues, that is on the person who was responsible for the compression at the company.
Absolutely.
Okay, so it's not like... It rarely is it like, we got bad materials from Japan.
No, banding could be a materials issue.
Okay.
Glitches, usually a materials issue. You know, anytime there's a, you know, dropout or like a glitch in the screen or something, that's usually something on the master.
Okay.
But compression artifacts, almost always the fault of who's ever doing the compression for the disk.
Okay, and when you say banding, just explain what that is.
Banding is when a gradient, you notice, like, individual, it's not a smooth degradation from, like, gray to black or whatever. You see, like, the individual steps involved. It's almost like seeing a relief map.
Yeah, it's like you're turning the gamma up or down on like a computer game.
Right, exactly. It looks like, you know, one of those old video effects where, you know, everything looks solarized.
Yeah. Right. And that's usually in the masters itself. And is that like a production issue? Like that's something that happened in, like, when they were making the show?
It can happen in a number of different steps. There are certain color space issues that can happen anywhere from when they're making the final video to be put onto tape. It can happen at the tape stage. It can happen at the tape duplication stage. That's one of the great mysteries of anime production. It's like, where did this banding come from? We don't know.
Right.
I did get one. I have done one show that I will not name. That we got the master, and we just went, both me and the client just went, ooh, this looks bad. I've never seen banding this terrible. And they had me run some tests, and I actually did some heavy duty restoration on it to get rid of the banding, and was mostly successful. Then we looked at the Japanese Blu-ray release and saw Banding City. They didn't do a thing to it. I was actually very proud of that, and I'm kind of bummed out. I probably shouldn't say what show that is.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm sure people will dig around and maybe figure it out for you. But okay, well, so that's really interesting. Cause, so, like, I want when it comes to this kind of stuff, how fair is screen cap culture? And when I talk about screen cap culture, I mean, like, somebody gets a hold of an early rip or like a pirated copy of something or something like that, or they, you know, write stuff shipped to them 2 weeks early, and they get it and they pop it in and they take some screenshots and there's banding or some kind of compression artifacts or something, and it's like one screenshot or two screenshots, and then they start calling for like a boycott. Obviously, like, surely you've noticed this. I call it screen cap culture,
right?
What do you think of that? Like, how fair is it? Do you think it's these people are just they're being rational? Is that a reasonable thing? Is it okay to look at those screenshots and say, you know what, I'm not buying this because it looks like garbage?
I'm kind of ambivalent towards them, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a better way to have a discussion on video quality than with those screen caps. I really don't.
Right.
There's just no better way to discuss it. And, you know, just the act of taking the screenshot can introduce new artifacts that weren't actually in there.
Yeah.
So they can be a little unfair, especially if you do it wrong.
Right.
But people have gotten pretty good at them, especially the people that are really obsessed with this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, for DVD, because MPEG-2 is such old technology, and in motion, a lot of the film grain just turns into what looks like compression artifacts, and they are compression artifacts, to be honest. Mm. But Blu-ray is really capable of much better than that. And I honestly think that if any frame really looks bad enough to make you stop and take a screen cap and go, holy hell, why does it look like that? Then, yeah, that's probably a bad compression job, and someone probably should be held accountable for that.
Okay, so, like, one of the examples that pops into my head is, like, some of these, like, Disney's putting out a bunch of their old animated stuff, just catalog stuff, and they're just kind of dumping it out.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that stuff from, like, the 70s, it looks like shit.
Oh, yeah.
Smeary shit on Blu-ray. Like, they didn't really preserve, like, it's obvious they were trying to clear up the grain, But what they wind up doing is erasing lines, like, in the animation itself. Mm-hmm. Is that just, like, a filter that they're putting it through and saying, like, okay,
yeah, that's what that is. They're putting it through a degrain filter. And the problem with 70s, anything from the 70s and 80s, and anime runs into this, too, all the time, is the film grain back then. That's when everyone switched to a much cheaper film stock.
Yeah.
Especially if you were using Kodak back then. And the film grain went from the, you know, the gorgeous Technicolor stuff of which was exceedingly expensive, because Technicolor was actually three different bands of film that were then lithographed together, you know, red, green, and blue.
Yeah, right.
Like, that was insanely expensive, and actually it was so complicated and hard to do that we have forgotten how to do that. Like, we can't do that. We've tried, and we can't replicate what they were doing back then.
It's a lost art.
Completely. In fact, the patents were sold to a Chinese company, and, you know, if the Chinese can't copy your technology, you're lost.
Right.
So at any rate, so everyone switched to this really cheap Kodak stock, and it just was not there yet. And the film grain was the size of your fist, and it just looks terrible by today's standards. And so a lot of, you know, you put it through filtering software to try to get these huge grains out, because if you released it like that, nobody would be happy, not even the film snobs. Like, it looks grainy as hell. So you do what you can, you try to filter it, but when the original image is that far gone, you know, a lot of those lines in the original animation were just blurs and those giant grains anyway.
That's interesting, because the specifically some of the films I'm talking about, they were during Disney's Xerox period.
Mm-hmm.
So you were literally seeing rough draft, like, the animation has that horrible, like,
sketchy, really pencil-y look.
Yeah, where you're seeing, and they're reusing frames a lot, so this thing's been Xeroxed 7 times.
Yep.
And you're looking at something that's been drawn over a whole bunch, and they're just leaving in the animator's rough lines. So it basically, I would imagine the filter treats that like dirt.
Yeah, and you know, you have to, because the grain is so prominent, you have to crank it up so high to remove the grain that you just, yeah, you end up with a blur.
Yeah.
But wow. It's either, you know, you can play with those, the degrain tools for days and days and days and not really get that much of a better result if the original picture was so grainy that there's just no appreciable image left. A good example of this in the anime world is the first Galaxy Express 3-9 movie.
Right.
You know, when that Blu-ray came out from Toei a few years back, people were just like, what is this blurry mess? This is just like, it looks like flood fill and, you know, the lines are all globby. But that film stock was just so janky and so crappy. If you look at the opening titles, you can tell that even the credits aren't holding together. That stock was just crap. And they're honestly doing the best they can without tracing all of the lines over.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, you know, vectorizing the film. You know,
that's the next step. I mean, basically, you can always do a better job on film restoration. That's the inherent problem with film restoration, is that it can always look better, sure, if you just shoot it again.
Right, you have to remake it, though.
Yes. You know, and there are things that look so bad that, yeah, there are teams at Disney that are literally reanimating very quickly old TV shows because, you know, they were stored in a way that just doesn't hold up today.
Yeah, wow. So, like, it's just, like, you know, hearing you describe this, it's just there's so many different moving parts, so many different types of film elements that you're going to wind up working with, that some of these projects are just going to be nightmares no matter what you do. And there's, you know, unless they want to spend millions basically remaking the film.
Right, and, yeah. You know, Disney's never going to remake that by reanimating Fox and Hound.
Yeah, they're not. Well, actually, that one looks okay. The Sword in the Stone is, like, the worst example.
Ooh.
Like, that just looks like total crap. But
Robin Hood looks terrible.
Robin Hood doesn't look good. It doesn't look great, but it doesn't look as bad as Sword in the Stone.
Also, it's a fairly bright movie. Sword in the Stone's a dark movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always the dark areas that fall off. Actually, there's a very distinct problem that happens with anime that doesn't happen with Western, because you know, some of the film stocks they were using in the 80s were coming from Fuji. And that had a whole different problem where everything looked washed out. You might notice some older anime where the black level is just really milky.
Yeah, that and the yellowing.
Yeah, that's an aspect of the Fuji stock. And I've only ever... That's particular to Japan. I've seen that with a few Japanese live-action movies and a few trailers from Hong Kong films of the era. But I've never seen that in Western film. And I'm pretty sure that was an issue with Fuji film stock back in the day.
Wow.
The yellowing, I'm not sure where that's from. That could be the film stock. That could just be the exposure.
I want to see a short film about, like, a Toei employee who just happened to use the film stock vault as his, like, personal smoke break room over the span of, like, 30 years.
Honestly, nothing would surprise me. Nothing would surprise me.
He's like, no one will notice if I take a smoke break back here.
I mean, even recently, shows fall through the cracks, but, you know, back in the 80s, I mean, no one was taking care of this stuff. Things were happening too fast. No one was looking backwards. No one was thinking, hey, maybe we should take care of this movie that we just spent all this time and money on. Everyone was just all systems go making so much crap. And now, you know, we've lost a lot of it. That's a bummer.
Yeah. But I mean, the history of the basically recorded media or filmed media is as such where it's such a diverse a number of elements, like different film stocks, different film grades, different everything for everything over the years, that going, like, the further you go back, it just must turn into this fucking nightmare where you don't know, like, what kind of elements will you even have to work with to put out a good looking HD version of it.
You never know. I mean, new elements are discovered all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
like the story of how they restored the Godfather, you know. But the company that, you know, obviously Paramount was very interested in making sure that looked perfect. And
sure.
Spent all the money in the world to restore the hell out of it.
Right. And, you know, you get things like that in Japan, too, like Wings of Onyamas and you know, the Ghost in the Shell. They'll spend money till the end of time on those. But, you know, then you get, like, a 80s TV show. Where, you know, it was just, you know, use this quick return film stock, use the hot splicer to, you know, get it on the air as fast as possible. And, you know, once there's a tape master, oh, finally done. Put it aside, move to the next episode.
Right.
And, you know, then no one was keeping track what happened after that.
Yeah. Well, it was considered disposable back then.
And, you know, even today, like, there will be occasions, and I will not name names here, but, you know, the production committee system is making it so it's very hard for one hand to know what the other is doing.
Right.
You know, so the Japanese company will spend all this, or the Japanese home video releaser will spend all this money doing a Blu-ray remastering, and the company that has the rights to sell the overseas rights either won't know that master exists, won't know what happened to it, because maybe that happened a few years ago, or they just can't use it at all.
Yeah.
Man. That happens all the time.
So I wanted to know, like, if you had an example of... now, people, you know, Blu-rays come out, and people who are very impressed with the image quality or whatever. Although at this point, like, it's so standard that I don't think people even use the phrase reference quality anymore.
Right. Like, if you did a good job, you can't tell the disc from the master.
You can't tell. Sure. But I was wondering if you had an example of, like, okay, this looks as good as you can get. Like, the best Blu-ray you've seen. Like, something you would say, like, if somebody was like, okay, I have not... Like, I have an HD TV, but I don't really pay attention to HD stuff. Like, I don't notice picture quality difference, which to me is, like, every time anyone says that to me, I'm like, are you blind? Like...
Well, to be fair, there is a lot of stuff that it doesn't... Like, there is not a huge difference.
I guess. To me, it's... Like, SD versus HD is night and day to me, but... If you had, like, one disc or something, it was like, okay, this is as good as you can get, and then also as bad as you can get. Like, the worst Blu-ray you've ever seen.
Well, on the good side, there's so many to choose from. I mean, I still blind buy Blu-rays for the most part, right. And have been burned very, very few times. Anything from Criterion is probably reference quality. Anything from well, most current stuff from major studios is reference quality. To show off my projector downstairs, I usually pop in Pacific Rim.
Right.
Anything from the Ghibli catalog usually looks amazing. And that they are using those same transfers for the U.S. releases, so those look great. In terms of stuff from the U.S. anime companies, let's see. All of the stuff, almost most of the imports of the big shows look great. Wings of Onyamis looks great. It's all over the place. Anime is a funny thing because so much of it is made digitally now, and there was never an analog element to it. So there's no need to touch the color correction. There's no need to do anything. What we have is pretty much what the master looks like. But the master was made in 720p. So,
right.
Can you call that reference quality? Not really. But that's exactly what the show looks like. The disc was made perfectly.
Yeah, which I feel like that's something that escapes a lot of people's notice, is that most anime is not made in 1080p.
Still. Yeah, very, very little of it.
Yeah, so...
mostly like, just movies.
That costs a lot of money to make shows in 1080p, so they don't do it that way. And also, right. Most people don't really notice. But if you're looking at a Blu-ray and you're like, hey, this doesn't look... this looks a little blurry or whatever. Yeah, because it's not full HD resolution. The show wasn't produced in that resolution. So, they're not pointing a camera at actors. They're not pointing a 1080p camera at actors. They got to film it. They have to create it at a certain resolution. And they're just, I guess, money-wise, it's not worth it to produce.
And, anime is line art with flood fill for the most part.
Right.
With all these nice gradients and lighting effects, sure. But it is still line art that doesn't move a whole lot. So it's easier to compress. It's easier to scale. It's just modern... video technology can work with anime very easily. So there is not, you're not, it's fairly, I thought, fairly idiot-proof to encode a disc. I have been proven wrong.
Right.
But, honestly, the biggest challenges I have when I compress video are live action stuff. Anime is stuff, I can cut corners. I don't, but I can.
Right. Wow. So, do you have, a worst? Because mine's still that Interstellar 5555.
Oh, nothing's going to beat that.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to beat that. That was the worst Blu-ray I've ever seen, period.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I can't believe that was released.
I still have it. But if I want to watch that, I put on the DVD.
For anime-wise, besides that, the worst anime Blu-rays I've seen is the stuff from King Record in Japan, where they took old... D2 analog masters of Catgirl Nukunuku and 3x3 Eyes and just upscaled those slapdash without any filtering and it's still interlaced and just shat them out on disc. They look terrible.
Yeah, well, the audience for those shows is minuscule, so maybe they were hoping no one would notice.
Hey, I would buy Catgirl Nukunuku again.
All right, well.
Actually, no, I wouldn't.
I was going to say, what?
No, I wouldn't. That was fun when I was 14, and I don't think I'd enjoy that today.
So I did want to ask, now a lot of people have said this, and I've noticed it myself. R1 Blu-rays of recent anime sometimes don't look as good as the Japanese version. Now, I don't know if that's just my lion eyes or what, but I'm wondering if you can shed any light onto why there's a discrepancy between
the quality. It could be any number of things, honestly. It could be the American publisher isn't encoding right. It could be the tapes, when they were duplicated or captured for that publisher, were done in a way that diminished the image. That happens.
Okay.
Sometimes it's willful. Probably. Sometimes it's not. The whole reverse importation thing.
Right, they're very scared of that.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's because they have to or want to add the English titles and credits onto a show, which, honestly, if they're doing it right, shouldn't cause any problems, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes that can be a way to introduce artifacting problems. There's all sorts of things that that you can point to. For the most part, I think the U.S. companies do a fairly good job. I can count on one hand the number of discs I've been dissatisfied with.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't suggesting it was like a widespread problem. It's just that when I see sometimes I'll see like a Japanese Blu-ray playing, and it will look, you know, just sharper, crisper, colors are brighter, they pop more. Like, it just looks a little bit better. A lot of people complain, like, oh, it's not like the R2, whatever they call it. I'm sure you've noticed that as well. Like,
yeah, that happens less and less these days. That happened a lot with DVD. I don't see that it happening anywhere near as much with Blu-ray, although it does still happen every once in a while.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that they're putting, like, two episodes on a Blu-ray?
Actually, no. You can really comfortably fit up to about 9 episodes on a Blu-ray and not take any real noticeable quality hit.
Yeah, so what about those Sentai discs that have, like, the entire show?
I'm skeptical. I haven't actually seen one yet because I haven't wanted any of those shows.
Right.
But I'm skeptical. But it could work. I mean, I've not tried to go that low bitrate wise. It might look okay. I would be doing a lot of hand wringing and a lot of worrying and a lot of dissecting before I let that one go out the door. Let's just put it that way.
Right. So it's kind of like pushing the car. It's like pushing the car up to a speed you're not sure it can handle.
Yeah, pretty much. Honestly, like, the websites that are supposed to keep on top of these things, they're not that hard to please these days. I've seen discs that I just thought looked really, really questionable, and the sites gave them a pass.
Well, I mean, you know, this,
and like, I was the only one that was angry that I could find online, so I'm just like, well, fuck, I guess no one actually cares that much.
Well, or they're just not seeing the things that you are. I mean, you do it professionally, you know, so you're gonna obviously notice stuff that most people don't.
I expect people who work for video file websites to have eyes as keen as mine. I don't think I'm being unreasonable there.
Well, I didn't say you were. I'm just saying, you know, you do actually do it for a living. There's always going to be a difference between enthusiast and professional. Like, you know.
So some of the movies that they gave a pass to, I will not name names here because they were anime releases. I can't believe that they were that people were really okay with that. They looked so crappy, and I was really upset because I actually wanted those movies.
Yeah, well, well, what are you going to do? I mean, you could start your own video enthusiast website.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
You're like, ah, fuck that. Okay, so we got a bunch of Twitter questions for you, so let's get to these.
All right,
Dr. Swarov asks, have independent authoring houses... All right, this is grammatically tripping me up. Do independent authoring houses ever get work from major studios, or do the studios have all of their authoring done in-house?
Well, the major studios, the huge Hollywood studios, with their own home video departments, they do all of it in-house. Mm-hmm. A surprising number of fairly major, smaller DVD companies, like I believe Anchor Bay used to be like this, do outsource to smaller shops and post-production facilities. I'm unaware of another house as small as mine.
No, it's just you, right?
Yes.
It's literally your house.
I do a lot of stuff. Yeah, so to answer your question, the majors don't. A couple of the middling players do. There's not a whole lot of competition in the Blu-ray market. The tools are too difficult.
But aside from just doing Blu-ray stuff, you also mentioned mastering stuff for like Hulu, like getting something ready for Hulu.
Yep.
And other streaming services.
Yep. Hulu, Netflix. I've done. I've sort of indirectly prepped stuff for iTunes, but yeah.
All right. So what? Give us sort of the short version of that. What's that like?
All right. Those are what you give those services are something called mezzanine files. And mezzanine files are they're called mezzanine because they're meant to be in between. Because once you hand it off to them, they then compress it themselves to make all of the different bitrate versions that it switches between when you're streaming it. So what you have to give them is the cleanest possible thing that they can just easily plug into their system. With Hulu, that means that you have to splice in some black for commercial breaks and then give them the time code of those breaks so they can add in their insane number of commercials. Some of them also have other rules, like, you know, a frame of black at the beginning, a second of black at the end, something like that. iTunes specifically has a rule where the credits aren't, no part of the video is allowed to have a URL in it. You know, little things like that. But the biggest one is that everything has to be completely progressive with no frame blending, and that can be very difficult. So, you know, if you have an older show and it's not perfectly transferred to video and there's a little bit of, frame lagginess where like half the screen is the next frame or something, Hulu won't take that at all. Actually, Netflix won't take that at all anymore either. Okay. Yeah. So unless you have brand new masters of a lot of shows, there's a ton of, like, there's a lot of old stuff on Hulu, but there's even more that we just, unless there's a new remastering that happens in Japan from the original film elements, we can't do anything with it digitally. Kind of a shame.
Yeah. No kidding.
But yeah, there are other stuff like, you know, early DigiPaint shows where it's mixing frame rates. You know, you have CG that's at 30 frames, then the cell animation that's at 24, and then, you know, it's all one big interlacy mess. Those are a nightmare too, and you have to kind of fudge them and do the best you can. Nowadays things are a lot easier because most anime is made fairly reliably at 24 frames a second, so you don't really have to worry so much about that.
So
then you compress it in their preferred format and you upload it, and some of those files are really, really huge, and it's just like, I'm not uploading this. You can have this hard drive. Here you go.
As if you get like a big batch of things at once.
Or even a single movie, because sometimes they want those things and it'll be 100 gigs. Like, I'm not uploading 100 gigs. I'm just not. I'm still using Charter cable modem over here. No.
Yeah, I think, like, I pay for the most expensive internet I can get, and it's like 5 megs up.
Imagine uploading, like, a 50-episode TV series, each file almost 8 gigs. You just have to let it run for a week.
Yeah, well, I don't know, my down speed, like, down, that would be no problem. You know?
Yeah, but up?
Yeah, up, no way. No way. No way.
I don't think my landlord would be too happy with me if I ran a CS3 line in here, but...
Yeah, probably not. So, I mean, so is the Hulu stuff, like, you know, preparing stuff for streaming services, is that it's easier than Blu-ray, or, like...
Oh, yeah. I can do that with my eyes closed.
Okay.
Nothing is harder than Blu-ray.
Okay.
Nothing is harder than Blu-ray. And, you know, the number of things that can go wrong with Blu-ray are so myriad that... You know, we all get hugely stressed every time there's a new release because it's like, did we miss something? Oh my God, we missed something. We're all going to die. We have to recall everything. Oh God.
Oh, and that was the other thing I wanted to ask. So, like, you know, we've sort of hinted at, like, some of the stuff you've worked on.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, what discs coming out, like, in the next, like, 6 months or 5 months or whatever time frame you want to put on it? Like that you worked on, like, would you like people to know about? Like, I worked on this and this and this.
Let's see. Toradora just came out from NIS, so it just looked pretty nice, and it has a nice spanking new dub on it.
Mm-hmm.
That giant Cardcaptor Sakura box set, holy cow, that one almost killed us all, but it's worth it. It's a fantastic, looking show, and I'm really happy to have been a part of that. That was really awesome. So that's NIS. There's something that is coming out from Discotech that I just gave them the BDR for, but I'm not sure they've announced it yet, so I'll just keep quiet.
Okay.
Just wrapped Bloodlad for Viz.
Okay.
Through Bang Zoom. That came out pretty fancy. The menus on that are really, really snazzy. I like how that one turned out. That's what is coming down the pike for me.
All right, let's get back to these questions here. Ebonas3R asks, when can we expect a scathing tell-all book from your time in the industry? And how much do you dedicate to the saga of Doggy Poo?
Oh, boy. You know, as the years go by and the memories of Central Park Media fade, you know, it's hard to look back on that time as anything other than it's like, oh, God, I was so green. I learned so much. They put up with so much from me by paying me garbage.
Well, you were in your early 20s, right?
I was 20 when I started.
You're a baby, so.
I was a zygote.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was such an annoying little dweeb.
Weren't we all?
Right. But the other thing was, you know, there weren't a whole lot of other anime nerds at that company. And so often I was the voice of like, no, you have to actually try.
These people care. The people who are buying the stuff care.
Yeah. CPM was a company that we didn't know if the discs looked bad because they were so cheap. We were using these ancient $120 old tube displays from Kmart for all the QC and first generation DVD players. I mean, we had no clue those discs looked that bad.
I mean, if anyone's going to write the CPM book, it's going to be John O'Donnell, right?
I've tried to get John to come on and talk about anything, and he won't do it. He's done with the anime business.
Right, of course.
So I doubt that'll happen. But
I would
honestly, that would be such a ridiculously one-sided and completely probably erroneous and very self-aggrandizing.
Yes, I would read
tome.
I would read the fuck out of that memoir. I would read the fuck out of that memoir. Like, I'm sure it would be totally self-aggrandizing, but I would read the shit out of it. I'm sure you would, too.
I mean, this is a guy who told Japanese licensors, no, F you, I'm going to be doing it this way, rather than put up with their approval BS. And consequently got frozen out of licensing anything.
Right.
Shock of shocks.
Oh, J-O-D. Yeah. Okay. Graceful Nanami asks, have you ever had to deal with recalls or disc issues? What's the process of dealing with that kind of situation and its effects?
Well, at my end, it doesn't really affect me all that much. Basically, I just have to open up the old project file and, you know, fix what needs to be fixed, export it again, and send it off to the replicator again. Mm-hmm. Only one I've done that for is Daily Lives of High School Boys disc where NIS recalled it because there was a little tiny one frame glitch on one episode that nobody noticed, which I still can't believe they did that. That was kind of incredible to me. Like, nobody noticed. No one was complaining.
But they still recalled it.
Yeah.
Well, they do give a shit over there.
They really do. Like, I'll never forget, like, when I first started working with them, they were just like, we want our discs to look every bit as good as the Japanese release. Just every bit. I'm like, let's do it. I can do that.
All right. Our buddy Daniel Zelter asks, and this is a good question, actually. He says, the only thing I can think of to ask is, do you work for non-anime companies, which you do. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
The stuff I do for CJ Entertainment, the Korean live-action films, that's really cool because some of those end up in Redbox.
Right.
And some of those movies are pretty sweet. But that all comes through my partners at Bang Zoom. So, you know, they're already dubbing those shows at Bang Zoom, and then Bang Zoom's handing them off to me to make the discs.
Right.
So there's that. Indie film-wise, it's usually like one-off discs for theatrical screening. There are some theaters that don't have a full, you know, digital cinema server, so they're playing stuff off BDR. So I make special screening discs without menus for that. I've made a couple for indie filmmakers, and I've just, every time I do that, I have to walk them through the process, and that's usually, you know, the learning curve just to producing a Blu-ray, even without directly authoring it, can be pretty steep, so, you know, that's a lot more work. But it can be fairly rewarding because, you know, without you having kept your prices low, and, you know, walking them through the process, those discs probably just wouldn't have happened at all.
Right. I mean, can you give us any examples of, like, you know, films that you've worked on?
DVD or live action wise, there was a documentary I did a while back called American Made Movie. That was a documentary about the fall of American manufacturing. That was an interesting project. I wrapped that a few months ago. Did a DVD of a Hawaiian hula dancing drama called The Haumana. Did a just a regular DVD of that, and I think we're working on a Spanish language DVD now. So yeah, there's all sorts of stuff.
That's a little.
These are all little indie projects. They're not coming from any major studios.
Right. Okay. DigiCarrot asks, apologies for the multitude question, but I seem to recall Justin has been doing some work for non-US labels like Anime Limited here in the UK. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I did. I've only done two projects with them so far, but I'm told more are coming. So knock on wood.
All right. He says, is it just BD work, or have you done DVDs? In the event of the latter, how much fun is it dealing with getting often interlaced NTSC video content into a PAL video format? He says it's something that has proven somewhat fraught with cock-ups over the years. I'm pretty sure this guy's from the UK because
he used the phrase cock-ups.
Cock-ups, yeah.
PAL sucks. PAL is 25 frames a second when you make a DVD. And so, you know, your anime master is either 2997 interlaced or 24p. The only way to get it from 24p to 25p is to either speed it up 4% and try to pitch the audio so it doesn't sound too sped up. Still sounds terrible half the time.
Yeah.
Or you have to blur the frames together, and that looks even that looks terrible.
And then you get the weird slowdown. That weird slowdown effect in the audio.
Oh yeah, that's what happens when you go back the other way.
Oh okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually it sounds sped up. I've done two DVDs for Anime Limited so far. The first one was Perfect Blue, and the second one was that new Outlaw Star box. Luckily Anime Limited just said, you know what, everyone in the UK can just play NTSC DVDs. It's not a big deal. Just make them an NTSC. So we did. And so far, no problems. I don't know why everyone isn't doing this.
That Outlaw Starbox, I mean, like, that show hasn't been reissued on DVD in the US in forever.
It looks way better. It's the new master from Japan.
So it looks pretty good.
Oh, yeah. It's we were actually having to go back to the old Bandai Masters to pull the dub.
Oh, yeah.
And resynchronize it. And, man, what a huge difference. That old dub has rainbows. It's washed out. It looks like, you know, late 90s anime.
Right.
And, it's a huge improvement.
Cool. A lot of people like that show. I don't, but a lot of people like that show. I never got into that. Did you ever get into that?
I was not part of the fan base for that, although I was revisiting it again after all these years. I was kind of impressed by how bro it is.
Yeah.
It is a super bro anime. Maybe that's why we liked it in the States so much.
It's just ugly as shit. Like, it's so ugly. I hated the design on that show, especially that weird... The ship itself is just this weird, like, penis with arms on it. Like, it's bizarre looking. I don't know. Anyway.
Penis with arms on it?
Yeah, kind of, right? Like, it's just... you know what I'm talking about.
I never put that together, but...
Well, I'm a weird guy. Anyway. okay. Jose CNN asks, what compression codecs, ProRes, DNX, HD, do the licensors send out? You mentioned they still do send HDCam tapes out.
Yep. Every once in a while... I mean, no one can really use those here because those decks are so expensive they have to pay somebody to capture the file anyway.
Right.
So most of the licensors these days can send a ProRes file. It's almost always ProRes.
Right.
Occasionally you get just uncompressed QuickTime, and those are huge, and then you... I just convert it to ProRes because they're so unwieldy. It's like 600 gigs or 600 gigs for a movie.
So actually, I meant to ask this. So you're talking about these gigantic files. Your rig, like your chief rig that you use for dealing with these files, like, I know you bought that crazy trash can $6,000 Mac or whatever the hell it was. I think we talked about this in the show a little bit.
It my baby.
So you really got to stay on top of the hardware.
I do, but I don't. I mean, I'll be honest. When I was first making Blu-rays, I had actually just repurposed my old home theater PC. But I was doing all the encoding on the Mac Pro, which, despite being a 2008 model, was still an 8-core, you know, Xeon processor. You know, it was still a fairly muscle machine. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I'm like, when I started doing more than two of these a month, I was just like, ooh, I really need to buy an actual workstation. So I built a Windows box with like a current, you know, Core i7 processor and everything. And it actually did, it cut the compilation time in half. And I was just like, oh, I guess that's what happens when you use real hardware to make real things.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, you get what you put into it. I mean, and when you're juggling as many projects as I do, yeah, every second counts sometimes. There are weeks where, you know, things are fairly slow, and there are weeks where I'm just running around like crazy. And those weeks, I really, really need, I really need every bit of horsepower I can get.
Right. It's also fun to buy new tech.
No comment. I totally don't go to the Apple store just to smell the place.
Yeah, right. okay. Also asked...
I don't cry a tear when I open a Mac for the first time. I don't.
Okay, okay. he also asks, Jose CNN, which lossless W3HD, DTS-HD format do you find yourself using more often, or which ones do your clients prefer?
Nobody really has any. We use LPCM for stereo because it's just easiest. It's just a WAV file. Mm-hmm. I don't have W3HD because that software is $2,500, and DTS Master Audio does exactly the same thing and was a few hundred. So, that's that. DTS Master Audio works just fine. The only thing is, if you use it to encode stereo, it ends up bigger than the WAV file.
Okay.
So, that's why we just use WAV files for stereo.
Right, and it, you know, gets to a point where it's like you can't really notice the difference.
There is no difference. It's lossless.
Right.
There is no difference. Okay. So you use whatever is handier and cheaper.
Exactly. Crusher J asks, you talked about this a little bit in Answer Man. I'm going to start that over again. Crusher J asks, you talked about this a little bit in Answer Man, but what do you think of Discotech's idea of sticking a bunch of SD content onto one BD?
Well, this is going to be interesting. I have it right here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The video quality probably will not be any different from the DVD, especially this time around. I think we're probably just going to reuse DVD assets because we need to do some testing on H.264 encoding to see if we can pull some dirty tricks to make it progressive. Because I would rather not have a whole disc that's interlaced when it doesn't have to be, but I'm worried about breaking Blu-ray because
right.
That happens real easily.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, it's going to be an interesting test because I really think that might be compelling to consumers to be able to have like 50 episodes on a disc and just play them straight through. You know, in case you feel like just marathoning 50 episodes of Samurai Pizza Cats. I'm really curious to see how this is going to go. I really am. I think, you know, the disc itself will be fine. It'll be exactly what you're expecting. But as for how it'll sell, I have absolutely no clue, and I'm really curious. It could be a cool way to distribute a whole lot of discs, because Lord knows it can be kind of cumbersome to deal with, like, you know, 12, 20 discs for a long series.
Yeah, it gets annoying.
I mean, imagine if, you know, somehow Discotech or Right Stuff or whoever licensed Rescued Urusei Yatsura. A, I wouldn't want to review it. B, you know, it would be so much easier just to take all the old Animego, work Animego did, keep it standard def, and just throw it on a bunch of, throw it on like six BDR Blu-rays instead of, you know, 20 DVDs. That would be so much easier.
I think that's more than 20 DVDs.
40? Yeah, I think it was 40, wasn't
40, it? 40, something like that, yeah. And those Blu-ray boxes are out in Japan.
Oh, right, they remastered them into HD, so we'd actually be shortchanging you if we did that. Never mind.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe something a little less universally well-loved than...
You want hundreds of episodes of a, you know, middling sitcom? I love Lum, but it's a middling sitcom, and it's hundreds of episodes. You have to wonder, at what point is this worth it? Like, who wants all of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Good on Viz for taking on Ranma, I guess, but...
Yeah, seriously.
Still talking hundreds of episodes of a middling sitcom. Anyway, Exodore US asks, biggest disappointment of moving from analog to digital, and again, SD to HD, and or biggest pain?
Biggest pain... Well, honestly, the biggest pain in both instances is how crappy everything looks now, and ways of trying to mitigate that. Basically, the further we get from the days of Laserdisc, the worse everything that was made back then looks, and you realize just how poorly future-proofed everything was. And if you can't go back to the film masters and you don't have the money to do a remaster, it's just always going to look that bad, and that really sucks. There is so much, so just piles and piles of old anime that are never going to look great, and that's a really depressing thought to me. I would, if I was independently wealthy, I would be blowing so much money just buying random obscure OAVs and, you know, paying to restore them just so I can, you know, sit on them, because no one would ever release those here.
It's a very strange fetish, Justin.
I'm a very strange person.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, like, one of the biggest... Like, anime hit its boom right when DigiPaint was like, the thing.
Right. No, DigiPaint shows are what they are. You're never going to improve on them.
Yeah, right. But, like, a lot of media, it seemed like a lot of media, like, late 90s, early 2000s media, just, it kind of looks shitty.
Oh, yeah, it's done, terrible.
Yeah, it looks shitty. So, like, anything from, like, 98 to, like, 2004, it's gonna look like crap, and there's nothing you can do about it short of remaking it. Like, even movie, like, Hollywood movies from that period, the CG is awful.
Yeah.
Because they were doing, digital replacement stuff, and the tech wasn't there at the time.
So, no, I mean, that, you know, there's nothing you can do, because that's just, that is what the art is, and you can't really improve on it much.
Right.
I'm what depresses me is, like, TV series from 1985, you know, an OAV here and there that just, you know, has been out of print since it originally came out, and, you know, it becomes an art preservation thing.
Right.
You know, the best surviving copy shouldn't be a fan restoration.
Yeah.
You know, off of a VHS. That's not okay.
At the same time, that fan restoration will live forever. You know, it's...
Yeah, but think of how much better it could be if we were able to get and do a new scan of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course that would be better. I'm not arguing anything
else. I'm thinking of shows like Toei and 19 and, you know, all the stuff I wrote about years ago that, you know, nobody in Japan shows any love to, so we sure as hell can't get it here.
Eh, well. Okay. Keikaku Ed asks, were the Toradora Blu-rays an upscale, or was there an HD master? I'm getting a lot of signal noise from them.
Signal noise? Really?
That's what he's saying.
I don't know what that means in this context. They're not very noisy, that's for sure. They're pretty clean. They are at least somewhat upscale. I don't know exactly what those are. I'm pretty sure the animation was done in SD, but so they, first of all, I'm pretty sure whatever they took to upscale from came from very early up the production chain, because there were problems that were in the original standard def master that are not in this master. Fades that were done in 2997 interlace that are suddenly perfect 24p. You know, edge enhancement, color, just the way the color looks. It's not, I don't think it's definitely not 100% native HD, but I really hesitate to lump it in with the rest of the upscales either. It looks way better than that.
Mr. Mega Millions asks, with Cargap Sakura Sailor Moon being recently rescued, this is a little off topic, what is the new unlicensable anime stuck in licensing hell?
I don't know.
There's not much left.
Meizane Koku?
Yeah, sure, Meizane Koku. I guess there's people out there who really want Legend of the Galactic Heroes to happen.
Right. Yeah, there's... We can always dig up something that no one in their right mind would sell or buy.
The big money bombs have been mined at this point.
Yeah.
Like, the thing that... The stuff that's going to make anyone any kind of real money, that's been mined. Sailor Moon was the holdout, so, you know... I don't think there's much left.
There's a number of things that I wish, you know, the current rights holder, the current people who can do them are would be a little less stingy or maybe sublicense them to other people. For example, you know, half the Sony Pictures catalog that's anime would be really nice in a new home. I would love to have Tokyo Godfathers and all that stuff on Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
Never gonna happen.
Oh my.
Memories?
Yeah, that would be nice to have.
Yeah. Actually, the Japanese Blu-ray, I bought the Japanese Blu-ray of Memories, and unfortunately, all of the CG cuts, which are quite numerous, were rendered in really low res and then printed to film.
Uh-oh.
So every time there's a special effect shot, it suddenly goes to half resolution and looks a little washed out. It's a little depressing. But that was just the technology of the day. There's not really much they can do about that.
Right, short of doing like a Star Trek thing where they remake it. You know, they go in.
But you literally have to remake the whole cut.
Yeah, right. That's what they do with the Star Trek.
Oh my god, really?
Yeah, they go in and remake all the special effects and then relayer everything back together again. It costs them millions of dollars, but enough people buy Star Trek to where, you know, I guess it's worth it for them.
I thought they only did that with the first volume, and then they went, we can't keep doing this.
No, they kept doing it.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. They had to redo all those video effects, otherwise the show would just look like fucking trash.
That is very true.
That's exactly the same issue. Super low-res CG from the 80s. Or the early 90s. doesn't transfer to HD very well. And it's all in video. Like, that stuff was shot on tape, not on film. So...
Star Trek Next Gen?
Next Gen was, yeah.
Next Gen was film.
Next Gen was tape.
No.
That's what everyone was saying. It was all shot on tape. That's one of the reasons they had to go back and redo all the CG stuff.
The CG was, but I'm pretty sure all of the, like, stuff with actors on a set, that was all shot on film.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, you're right. Yes. No, that's the distinction. So the CG stuff was all on tape.
Right.
So they could go in and replace all those elements. But maybe it wouldn't be that simple for Memories? I don't know.
They probably don't have anything left.
That simple is in quotes, of course. Anyway. all right. Friend of the show, Brady Hartel, asks, we've had Blu-rays for about 8 years. Why is the tech still so proprietary? Seems like consumer-level DVD authoring happened faster.
Because it's so damn complicated. What really turned the corner on DVD, in my opinion, was when Apple got in the game and they released DVD Studio Pro. Mm-hmm. And that just made it so easy to make a DVD that more or less any reasonably tech-savvy person could put one together. And, you know, with a little work and getting good, they could come up with a pretty much Hollywood-quality disc. With Blu-ray, it's just so complicated, and it's so there's really no good way to simplify it. That's just, I don't see that happening ever. And Apple sure didn't. So, you know, in the meantime, there were a lot of other companies that tried to simplify things. For example, Adobe, they had Adobe Encore, and they've discontinued it now, but that could sort of do Blu-ray, but the way it did it was so broken and kludgy, and you couldn't really go to replication with it, that it wasn't even worth bothering.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, I think Blu-ray was never really seen as something that was as accessible as DVD. It was made in a way to sort of keep the riffraff out, for better or worse. And it's still a lot more expensive to make a DVD, or to make a Blu-ray than it is a DVD.
Okay. Last couple of questions here. Mask Miss asks, do you adjust your color settings to make them look good on a variety of screen types, or just your screen calibration? But, I mean, you said you don't do the testing on that.
I mean, there are occasional things where I have to color correct, but for the most part, you leave well enough alone. Japan made the color a certain way. It's all digital. It reproduces fine. Don't screw with it.
And we were talking about nightmares earlier, man. Dealing with, like, color temperature on, like, movies from the 70s.
Ugh. Yeah, you don't. There is no winning that one. No. There is none.
Well, it's either going to look blue or orange. Which one do we pick? Midnight Lily asks, why do some companies make it so you can't skip the previews of new shows when you put in the disc? Most people don't do that, actually. A lot of people complain about this on Funimation Blu-rays. You can just hit the menu button, and it does.
Yeah, I've never seen an anime Blu-ray that was like that, ever.
Yeah. Like, if you know the button to hit,
yeah,
then you're good.
There are some earlier, more on DVD than Blu-ray. I'm not sure it's happened on Blu-ray yet either. Hollywood Studios that did that. But, you know, no one disrespects their market like Hollywood.
Well, when your market's that big, you know, you can't make everyone happy.
Or anyone.
All right. Okay, actually, I think that wraps us up. That was a long show. Thanks for taking all those questions and going through that in meticulous detail.
I hope I didn't just go too nuts for everyone. Really worried about this show being too techy.
It was the whole point of having you on, was to go through the process. Like,
okay.
A lot of people are curious and want to know, and you actually do it. Like, you make the Blu-rays. Like, people want to know how the sausage is made. We just showed them, so it was cool. Anyway, it's weird to say thanks for coming on the show, Justin.
Yeah, please have me on again sometime.
See you next week. All right. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Justin for stopping by. Anyway, the theme song is called Bucharest by the band The New Division. You can check it out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd appreciate it, and we'll see you all next week.